This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Our guest, Kevin Brackney, served two tours in Iraq where he was a turret gunner. It was a dangerous job. He found adjusting to civilian life after his second tour difficult as he struggled with anxiety. He got help through his relationship with Nima, a service dog that is his constant companion. In fact, Nima is with us in the studio. Kevin is a presidential management fellow at the Delaware Commission of Veterans Affairs, is with the Philadelphia VA Medical Center. And Kevin and other veterans and their service dogs are profiled in a new book called Unconditional Honor, Wounded Warriors and Their Dogs. Kevin Brackney, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us are Ashley O'Hara and David Burry. They are father and daughter who are service dog trainers at PAWS Training Centers in Westchester, PA. Ashley O'Hara, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And David Burry, thank you for joining us as well.
It's good to be here.
And I should say they brought a dog with them as well. A Brooke is with us, so we are very happy. We have two dogs with us here in our Philadelphia studio. Kevin, I would like to begin with you and just talk a little bit about these two tours that you had in Iraq. You were there in 05, and then you came back for about 15 months or so, 07 to 09. This was a particularly, difficult, violent time in Iraq, was it not?
Yes. I mean, in 2005, it was our it was the third time that we were having rotations of soldiers to Iraq. The first two rotations, if I'm correct, were 6 months. Ours was the first 12-month rotation. We actually convoyed from Kuwait to north of Baghdad, which was our area of operation, in what they would call at that time the Triangle of Death. That was Tikrit, Mosul, that type area. So then after about a month of being with the unit, they selected me to be on the convoy team. At first, I was a truck commander. I was basically like a riding shotgun. And then after a little bit of time, they saw something in me and put me up in the turret. I was able to make rational decisions under fire and kind of like control myself. So I
call
did that.
That a dangerous job. I mean, that's probably really an understatement about how dangerous that job was.
It can be dangerous. I mean, you're definitely the person that they're trying to get. At that time, they were in the early stages of viewing IEDs and things like that, piano wire and the bridges and things like that to kind of catch them that way. So there was, you know, that we were the people that returned fire, so that we were definitely a target to get.
And when you came back from Iraq, as I read about you, and this was after your second tour, you were struggling, yes? With anxiety, it sounded like.
Yeah, I had to play like the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan because I was so used to that noise. My journey with post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, was the quiet was really the thing that made me unnerved because when it was quiet in the different villages and things like that, that's when something was going to happen because the insurgents would warn the villagers and things like that. So when it was quiet, that's when your lack of a better term, your spidey sense was going crazy and you were, a little bit on edge. So I had to use that. I used alcohol to kind of self-medicate to get to sleep, things like that. So, yeah, I did have a little bit of a rough time, but that's typical of a lot of soldiers coming back from that. So I didn't really think of anything of it because I was in the military at that time. So you have that protective cocoon around you. So it doesn't seem out of the norm because other people are dealing with it in the same way.
And whose idea was it that perhaps you would need a service dog?
Well, that wasn't until after the second rotation in 07, 09. We were the first actual ordered 15-month rotation. The rotation before us was 12 months, and then they extended them 3 months. Then after returning from that, I was stationed in Baghdad. So we would roll out at night, the engagement, protocols and things like that. When we were able to fire changed a little bit. So, we weren't really able to fire as much and we received a lot of fire and we just kind of had to duck and take it a little bit. No. So that kind of, wore thin a little bit. And then once I returned, I had about 14 months left until I separated from the military. During the second rotation was when I, really, my wife and I got serious. Well, actually, after the first rotation, my wife and I were talking for a long-distance relationship over the phone and things like that. And then during the second rotation is when I determined that, she's the love of my life.
I'm going to marry this girl.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. I'm going to marry this girl. So at that time, I determined that, I'm done with the military. I didn't have the mindset to be able to be married and be in the military. I had to place, you know, my wife above the military. So at that time, I made a determination I'm going to be getting out. So I had about 13 months after I got back to kind of get myself ready, put out the resume, work on the resume, things like that.
Right.
Once I got back, that's when I really started to see that there was a difference in the way that I interacted with the world versus how what was considered normal within the world. So, you know.
Is that when the idea of a service dog
well, yes.
began to make sense?
It began to. My wife saw the story on Extreme Home Makeover with, I think it was Staff Sergeant Hill, if I believe correctly. My wife knows better than I. And she pointed out that that would be something that I would probably benefit from. I had the typical soldier response of, well, I'm okay. There's guys who are worse than me. Like I said, you know, the military, we're the most macho of the macho, so we're doing all right.
So I don't need a dog.
Exactly. I don't need any help. I'm fine. So, but after her pointing that out, I kind of realized different things, and there was a time when I took my daughter out to daddy-daughter date night, and I just was beside myself. I had my back to an opening. I couldn't handle it. I was just like in
anxiety.
Tears. Anxiety. Exactly. I had an anxiety attack. So at that point, I was like, I got to get serious about this. And, you know, then I applied and made the necessary steps in order to receive a service dog from Puppies Behind Bars.
And I do want to get to our other two guests, but just help us understand, you brought Nima with you.
Mm-hmm.
What does Nima provide for you?
Well, she knows 92 commands. There are commands that other veterans need that I necessarily don't. My biggest ones are watch my back, because I ride the SEPTA train into work all the time. So that's where she's on my left side primarily, and she's facing backwards. And if she notifies me, anybody comes from behind. Another one is block, whereas, you know, I'm in a conversation with someone.
Right.
Maybe they're getting a little too close to my personal bubble, term. So she would lay in front of me, and I would be able to step back and provide that personal space.
And you would say to her, block?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
so
I would give her block. Mm-hmm. Yes. So, and then the third one, I have her do a clear, which is where she goes into a room, check if there's anybody in there, turns on the lights. Some people need the command where it's not really necessarily a command, but they're having nightmares. The dogs are trained to pull the covers off and turn on the lights to wake them from those nightmares.
Wow.
So, I mean, there's a multitude of commands, and you usually kind of personalize it like a TV remote, you know, for the commands that are necessary for you to get through your normal day-to-day life.
And I do want to get to back to all of that. Let me get you in on the conversation, Ashley and Dave.
Sure.
And I noticed looking through this book that a lot of the dogs in here seem to be retrievers of some sort. And I'll put this to you, Ashley. Is that the breed that's the best kind for a service dog, or does that matter at all?
I'm not going to be very breed specific, but I will say that we do tend to use a lot of retrievers, golden retrievers and Labrador retrievers, just because of their likelihood of having that
retriever.
Ideal, yeah, exactly. That ideal temperament, very trainable, that type of thing. But I won't say that, you know, any other breed doesn't have that ability to be there. We just have found that there's a better likelihood with retrievers.
Now, you all brought Brooke. Dave, you brought your dog Brooke
yes.
to the studio. Tell us a little bit about Brooke.
Brooke is our demo dog. She goes with us everywhere. So whenever we do any speaking or whenever we do any events, fundraising events and things of that nature, we bring Brooke with us, along with another dog that I have at home who's a little bit of a knucklehead. She has also been trained through our Paws for Prisons program. She knows over 100 commands, but she has a little bit of doggy ADD.
Oh, so interesting.
That's Inslee at home. So I had to introduce her too, even though she's not here. Brooke is, she has the perfect service dog temperament. She's great with kids. She has an ability to, if there's someone who has a cognitive disability, she seems to just immediately soften and cuddle right up next to them. And she's a real good comfort to them.
What is the training process? And as Kevin said, you know, his dog, Nima, can do something, you know, more than 80 different commands.
Yeah.
I'm looking at you, Ashley. What is the sort of approach to training a service dog?
Well, we start at a very young age, when as early as 8 weeks old. And, you know, we were talking before the show here, and we all have very similar command sets.
Interesting.
So, yes, upwards of 100, around 100 commands where they need to know these things on spot. You know, you ask them regardless of where they're at and what their surroundings are, they need to be able to do this, you know, regardless. So we do start at a very young age. Sometimes it can take up to 2 years for these dogs to really be refined in all of their commands. We do a lot of praise-based training. So,
lots of treats?
A lot of treats. we tend to use a lot of Cheerios when they're, when they're young. So, yeah, it's a, we make it – it's a lot of fun. I have a great job.
And when we talk about, you know, 60, 70, 80, 90 commands, I mean, Kevin was talking about some of the things that NEMA can do.
Yep.
What else? I mean, turning on lights?
Sure. Well, we do a lot of medical alert training, so they will come up and alert someone, you know, regardless of its if someone has narcolepsy and they're starting to fade out a little bit, the dog can come up and alert them. Mm-hmm. They can retrieve things, you know, for somebody with a mobility disability. So they go across the room and pick something up, bring it back. They can alert to different times of day for people who forget to take their medications. We teach them at specific times to alert, that type of thing.
In fact, you've done diabetes alert dog training.
Yes, correct. It's quite interesting. So we'll take saliva samples from the person at when they have low, their lows and their highs, and we teach the dog to alert to that different. Yeah.
How does the dog know?
That is, it's mind-blowing to me. I don't know how they exactly know. They can smell the difference between what a high insulin is and, you know, what high blood sugars are. And,
wow.
Yeah.
And you have them, what, sniff the person? Sure. Dogs have incredible noses.
Yes, absolutely. We start with, it's called a scent wheel. So we start with them training around, you know, just different areas of the scent wheel and being able to pick up with a live sample and be able to tell what type of, you know, if it's a high blood sugar or not.
So there's a lot of good boy, good girl going on. Lots of praise. And that's really how dogs, train best. I'm thinking even beyond service dogs, but the idea for people that have dogs to use positive reinforcement.
It's the ultimate motivator, yes.
Yeah.
Because dogs want praise, yes?
Absolutely.
And the consistency of the commands.
Yeah.
You know, when they do the same action, you say the same command. Right. Yes, repeat the command.
Yep.
Good, you know, good NEMA or whatever. So just that consistency that, you know, they really can play off and know that, okay, I did what they were asking me to do. And
and encourage them through the process.
Yeah. Exactly, exactly.
Dogs want to listen to you. You know, they have that desire to please. So you're just teaching them really – what it is that is going to please you. What's going to make you happy is what's going to make them happy.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Ashley O'Hara, the voice you just heard, Dave Burry. They happen to be father and daughter, and they are also service dog trainers at PAWS Training Centers in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Also with us is Kevin Brackney. He was telling us about his two tours in Iraq and also the fact that he's got a service dog named Nima, who has helped him deal with some of his anxiety. I should add that Ashley and Dave brought a dog as well, and Brooke is with us as well. So we have four people, two dogs. It's a good hour on Radio Time. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. I was reading about a yellow Labrador retriever named Ron that works at the Walter Reed National Medical Center, helping veterans deal with the physical and psychological after effects of combat. That was an article in Stars and Stripes. Our guest, Kevin Brackney, who served two tours in Iraq, has a service dog named Nima, who helps with his anxiety. Also with us are Dave Burry and Ashley O'Hara, and they are service dog trainers at PAWS Training Center in Westchester, and they have also brought a dog with them named Brooke. And if you want to join our conversation, any questions or comments, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Kevin, you got Nima from a program called Puppies Behind Bars.
Yes.
These are dogs that are trained by prisoners.
Yes, they're trained with affiliated correctional institutions in the state of New York. The head of the Department of Corrections of the state of New York is actually on the board, so there's a lot of buy-in with the Department of Corrections. What happens is they are placed in the correctional facilities at 8 weeks old, and then they're trained up until 18 to 20 months.
Wow.
And made the determination whether they're going to be service dogs, explosive detection canines, or if they're even going to graduate, if it's a good fit for them to be either one of those.
And do they live with the prisoner then?
Yes, yes. They stay in the cell with them within their little crate, and they, you know, they really are raised by the entire group of guys. Because, you know, it takes a village to raise a service dog.
It does.
So there'll be times when they get, you know, they're frustrated because, you know, the dog is some just like, I'm done with these commands, leave me alone.
Right.
So they'll, you know, hand them off to another person. So they're handled in teams. So at that point, which they're determined that they're going to be service dogs, they put together a class. And usually they bring, my class, there was six people. And they brought seven service dogs. So you train with each service dog for a half day to see which is the best fit. There are some dogs where you could tie a stake around your neck and they're not going to want to have anything to do with you.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So, and, you know, some just bond right away. And that's what I felt with Nima, is when I trained with her for that half day, I was like, oh my gosh, I hope no one else wants her because she's the perfect fit. She's a great size for me. She's, you know, just perfect for me. There was just, you know, everything that you can think of. She's just smart. She knew the commands before I wanted to say them. And the biggest thing with her is everybody else had to go back to their room and practice with the service dog. I found that after the first day that I didn't need to do that because she was already to the point where she's like, I've done my homework. You need to go read up. So there was that going on.
You got to get up to speed.
Yeah.
Right?
Because you have to learn their language. I mean, so the set commands is their language, so you have to learn that. So there's a lot of homework while you're up there. And, you know, we were up there for 2 weeks. 1 week we trained with the guys in the correctional facility. The second week was our public access training. So you're training with the guys that have raised her, and you kind of learn the ins and outs and everything like that, what her triggers are, what, you know, what her keys are, how she's, you know, even just like the potty. If her tail's down, you know, she needs a potty, things like that. So you kind of get like the Cliff Notes version of, you know, her up until that point from the guys.
And I should add that one of the reasons we're doing this show is that this book was published, Unconditional Honor, Wounded Warriors and Their Dogs, and it does tell a number of stories, including Kevin's story. And Dave, you're in there as well. You spent some time in prison, and that was where you learned to train dogs.
Yes. Yes. I learned how to train service dogs in government housing.
That's what we call it, right?
That's a nicer way to say that. Yes, that's where I was, in prison. The Federal Bureau of Prisons has a lot of great programs to help inmates better themselves, physically, spiritually, with lots of great education programs. This was the first program that became available that actually ultimately helps someone else. It's a comprehensive
help
program.
Help you then?
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm talking about ultimately we're training a dog to help someone else.
Yes, I gotcha.
We have a comprehensive 2-year program to learn how to train a dog to become a service dog. When I first heard about it, I thought, well, this is great. You know, I'm going to learn how to train a dog. But I had no idea really what it involved, because it's a whole lot more than just training a dog commands.
Right.
You also learn how to train a dog to help someone with a disability. So we learn a lot about different disabilities and how the dogs can help mitigate symptoms of those disabilities.
And do you remember, it is amazing, and do you remember the first dog you trained?
Oh, you put me on the spot. Do you remember, Ashley? Was it Deja? I think it may have been Deja.
It was Deja. Uh-huh.
Yes.
It was a learning experience for you, too.
It was a huge learning experience. And I think the most rewarding part was that a lot of these folks that the dogs ultimately get placed with, they came into the prison system to work with you and the dog. So we got to show them how to use their dog to mitigate those symptoms. And then, of course, when I got out of prison, I continued to volunteer with the Pulse for People program and the Pulse for Vets program. And that's how we got started with the Pulse Training Centers, because Pulse Training Centers – 100% of our net proceeds go back to Pulse for People. It is a funding mechanism, really, for them.
Were you a dog person before prison?
We always had dogs around the house, yes.
But this is like another level.
A whole different level, yes.
Yeah. And for you, Kevin, who was the inmate that trained Nima?
Oh, well, she was trained initially at Bedford Correctional Facility, and then she was transferred over to Fishkill. This gentleman named Daryl really took her, and she blossomed with him. There was a great bond. She gained confidence, and she did great with him. His partner was Green Eyes. I didn't really pick up his name. We just referred to him as Green Eyes. He had green eyes. So there was that, like I said, that partnership there. But Daryl really just took her as a lump of clay and just really molded her into the outstanding service dog that she is now.
And do you know where Daryl is today?
Actually, he was released and is working for Puppies Behind Bars now. Yeah, so, I mean, like I said, the organization is really great once they've determined that that person has done right by the organization. They hire them on. I mean, the gentleman that knitted her that little mat that she's laying on currently, Gary, got a job with Puppies Behind Bars, and he's doing great. They're just a great organization that way. They really put their passion into the service dogs, into the guys there, and then also with the veterans. And, you know, Gloria Gilbertoga is tremendous. She's the little drill sergeant there, but she's got a heart as big as her voice. So she's a great person.
I'm also thinking, I mean, we're talking about, in many ways, actually, we're talking about working dogs. I mean, this is part of their job, is to help take care of somebody.
Absolutely.
What about when they're not working, so to speak?
Well, we say that, you know, when their vest comes off, they're allowed to play and be a dog. You know, it's important for them to still have that in their lives, to play with other dogs and run around and play with kids in the backyard and that kind of a thing. But when they put their vest on and they're out in public, they're a working dog. Mm. They're a service dog out there. They have to know that when that vest goes on, their behavior has to be on point.
And so, do they know? I mean, they learn to know that.
They learn that very early on, right when the vest starts being introduced to them. We teach that very early on.
Which is no horsing around.
Exactly, I mean, yep.
I'm thinking of perhaps dealing with stressful situations. Do dogs absorb some of that? I put that to actually all three of you, but you know, and I'm even with Nima, I'm thinking, I mean, as you said, Kevin, she helps you deal with your anxiety.
Oh, she definitely takes that stress on. And that's why the organization, they kind of put that out to us, that they need at least an hour and a half each day to kind of de-stress. Take that vest off, run around, just not be a service dog and just be a dog, just be a puppy running around. She loves to play with my daughter, Gianna. They run around, they conspire with each other, they take each other's toys, and then they, you know, they switch and trade. So there's definitely that bond going there, but they need that. I mean, because they take all that stress on, and that's unhealthy. That's what caused us to need the service dog, is holding on to all that stress. So by us releasing it to the dog needs a place, an outlet to release that stress also.
Would you agree with that, Dave?
I do agree with that, yes. The dogs, if they're in a situation where they're their handler is anxious, they're working and they absorb a lot of that because their focus is on their handler.
Right.
So at the end of the day, if they can run around and play and get all that stress out, that's very helpful.
I'm also thinking about just in what it involves to train a dog and then to, in a sense, sort of have to give it up. I mean, part of your job is to train it for somebody else.
Yeah.
But is there sort of a sense of loss on both sides? I'm looking at you, Dave, but Ashley as well.
Well, while in government housing, I trained many different dogs, and the dogs were with me for anywhere between 3 weeks to 3 months. So, yes, you do get attached.
Yes.
The bond is there, and you certainly do miss them. What makes it a lot easier is almost immediately we get another dog to train, and also we know from the very beginning a little bit about the person that this dog is going to. So if you can help, you know, accept the fact that, okay, we're just training this dog to help this person, it makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, I'm interested about that transition period, Ashley.
Yeah, I think that it is sad to, you know, not be training with a dog constantly, but part of our program is that these dogs have to be recertified annually. So at the very least, we're going to reconnect with these dogs and these people and see them face-to-face annually. But also, we keep in really close contact with them. When you're working with people this close and you really become a part of each other's lives, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I get text messages or pictures or, you know, I'm on Facebook with and friends with these people. I mean, they've really become a part of our family. Yes. It's, you know, it's a bond that you share not only with the dog, but with the person. You really get to know them really well. And
sure,
they keep you updated.
You're saying yes, Kevin.
Yes. Puppies Behind Bars, we just actually did an interview for a follow-up for a lot of the volunteers. She actually, when I got her, she had a two-volume baby book.
Two-volume baby book
would put anybody's baby book to shame. First haircut, first tooth, the whole nine yards. There's so much love put into these dogs, and I know you guys feel the same way, that it's not even like an obligation. It's what I have to do. Is I have to provide them pictures of Nima and things like that. I don't feel like that's like a burden of any sorts. It's like, look at, here's Nima, you know, at the train station. Here's Nima doing this. And a lot of the guys from Puppies, I mean, there's such a bond. I mean, even with the guys that when we were training with them in the correctional facilities, there's the things that they do. And to give that dog so freely to you, I mean, that's something that maybe they've never really felt unconditional love, and they've received that from the dog, and then they train the dog, and then they give them to you, and that's such a labor of love. I mean, it's just amazing. It really is, and it's humbling at the same time.
Is that something Daryl said to you, which was, you know, this is a dog
this was Daryl's first dog. So when we did the public access test, Nora, who runs the dog tags program, Nima's one of her favorites. And you can tell, like, I mean, I know when you guys go and recertify someone, when the dog sees you, it's just like a family reunion.
Absolutely.
It's ridiculous. I mean, I swear one of these times her butt's going to live off the ground because her tail is going so much. But the ability to allow them to reconnect and everything like that, I mean, it's just, you have to do it because it was such a big part of their life for so long. And like I said, Daryl got out and he's now working with the organization.
That's
he's
great.
Continuing that community service that he started in there. And I mean, to do that and to make productive time when you're in that situation, I mean, it just speaks volumes of their character.
Do you think you would be here without Nima?
I mean, I don't think I would have been able to go through the Presidential Management Fellowship interview. That was a five-hour-long interview. That was pretty rigorous. A lot of the things that I've been able to do in my life, yes, I would have been able to do some of it with the support of my wife and my family and my faith, but just the ability to go out and my wife not have to worry about me, that's taken a lot of stress off of her. And as I like to say sometimes, Nima is her narc. So if I, you know, it's just, you know, you always have those eyes on you. And instead of focusing on the world around you and what could possibly happen, you're like, okay, well, what's Nima doing? What are you sniffing at? So it takes that focus off all the scary things and kind of puts it back in their soulful eyes and to feel that love and to watch over you while you're not with your family at the same time. So like I said, it's something you don't expect. Like, I never saw a service dog before. And then when I received one, you think, oh, man, this is great. It's a service dog.
It's a dog.
Yeah, exactly. It's a dog. It goes with me everywhere. Wait a second. There's a dog in the bathroom with me. So there's those nuts and bolts things. But, overall, I mean, it's just amazing. And some of the questions that you get, it really helps you reacclimate into the society because you're able to talk about something other than, oh, you were in the military. I didn't like that conflict. Oh, you have a service dog. I had a black lab. Her name was. And then you're able to see that, you know, the people do care, and there are very caring people out there, and it's not what's going on in your head and the perception that you have of the outside world, and it's just amazing. Like I said, the ability to have a service dog integrate in your life and so fully, so quickly, it's just very humbling and exciting.
You're smiling, Ashley, as Kevin is talking there. You know
Absolutely.
What he's talking about?
Absolutely, yeah. It's pretty awesome to see the changes that these dogs make. It's life-changing, actually, on all ends of the equation. There's no words. There's no words that can really explain how amazing it is to see a person before having their service dog, and then once they have them, and once they grow together, and that bond strengthens over time, and the difference it makes in their lives. It's remarkable.
We actually have a Facebook comment, something else from Gail. She says, I wonder if you have a couple of minutes to cover the issue of fake service dogs with your guests.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the growing popularity of people simply purchasing a service dog vest online, and poof, their dog is magically transformed. Obviously, Dave, you want to take that first?
We see that quite often. It is troubling. There are too many organizations out there that charge ridiculous amounts of money for a dog who knows a few commands. They do prey on veterans.
Really?
They hand a leash over. They say, okay, here, we'll take a check for $30,000. You never hear from them again. There's no support. There's no training. and they think they have a certified service dog. Unfortunately, in many cases, these dogs aren't adequately trained. We have been petitioning Congress to set some more stringent laws on identifying exactly what a certified service dog is. They're starting to act, especially in military bases right now. They are, at the very least, wanting a dog who is claiming to be a certified service dog to be recognized by ADI, Assistance Dogs International, who holds very high standards. We certify all of our dogs through Paws for People. Paws for People has probably the highest standards in the industry. So we're very proud to be teamed with them. But it helps, I mean, because we're not just in business to train dogs and put food on our table. We really want to help change lives.
And it seems to me, I mean, the way you all are talking and even just meeting the two dogs here is that they have to be really well trained. I mean, certain ways it could be a life or death situation, Ashley.
Absolutely. And you can even go on a website. Some of these websites, just you go on, buy a vest and an ID card and answer a couple questions for $39.99 and slap that vest on your dog and they say it's a service dog. It's really, really troubling to see these things. And like my dad was saying, we are petitioning Congress. It's slow moving, but we are seeing laws being changed. I think that most people would be able to tell, you know, what dogs are a service dog, because these dogs are really, really well behaved, as opposed to, you know, some of these other dogs that just have a vest slapped on.
I have to say, I mean, we have two dogs in the studio here and not a peep out of them. I know you want to say something, Kevin.
No.
We have to just take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about service dogs. We have two of them with us here in our Philadelphia studio. Brooke is with us and Nima with us as well. Nima is our guest, Kevin Brackney's service dog, a dog that he found or was trained for him, a dog he needed after two tours of duty in Iraq. Dave Burry is a service dog trainer at Paws Training Centers in Westchester, PA. His daughter, Ashley O'Hara, also a service dog trainer at Paws. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines, and do stay with us much more. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about service dogs, wounded warriors. And one of the reasons we're doing this show is a new book called Unconditional Honor, Wounded Warriors and Their Dogs by Kathy Scott and Clay Myers. And all of our guests are pretty much featured in this book, which is why we asked them to join us on Radio Times. And again, we have two dogs who have joined us as well. Nima is Kevin Brackney's service dog, and Brooke is here as well. And Brooke is a service dog that's been trained by our guests, Ashley O'Hara and Dave Burry. Give us a call, any questions or comments to join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. One thing I just wanted to pick up on, and this is even beyond service dogs, but just people that have dogs or perhaps are training them to just be the regular family dog. And I guess this was reading from the Paws site. Exercise, praise, patience, consistency, clear boundaries, things like that. Is that
–
I'm looking at you, Ashley. I mean, no matter what
you summed it up in a nutshell.
But that's the approach that people should have, no matter what they want their dog to be.
No matter what they want their dog to do. Make sure the dog's really exercised. Make sure you're really consistent. Make sure you're patient with them. I probably say that in every single lesson I go to.
Because it takes time, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you really – it's, you know, similar to a kid. You know, you have to be really patient and – walk them through it step by step.
We also ask our handlers. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
We also ask our handlers and our customers to never even give the command unless you can follow through. So if the dog's, if you're in a hurry and the dog's in the backyard and you say come and you wait 3 or 4 seconds and the dog doesn't come and you, oh, I don't have time, you know, and I, you know, to go get my dog, and you slide the door shut and you walk the other direction, you really just taught your dog that they can come whenever they want. So please be consistent.
Well, and I'm thinking exercise, praise, patience, consistency, clear boundaries. I mean, that would work for children too, don't you think?
I think so.
Yes. I wonder, Dave, whether it's possible to either train or retrain dogs that have been abused. Have you worked with dogs that have been abuse, and you can train them to be a service dog?
It depends on what the dog is going to be used for and the disability of the person. It is a challenge. We have had some success with rescue dogs that we don't know a lot about their history, mm-hmm. but we have to work through some of the idiosyncrasies of their personality, and some commands have to be worked on a little bit differently. But it can be done. It is a challenge. Most of our dogs, we try to start training as a puppy, like Ashley had said earlier.
Right.
And if we can have control of their history from birth, it makes it a lot easier, and we have a lot better chance of success. Yes.
Getting them when they're young, Kevin.
And I think it's really unfair to ask a dog that's suffered emotional trauma itself to then take on that stress of the veteran or whatnot that's got PTSD or other issues. I mean, because they're going to both be working out issues. And like you said, you don't know how the dog's going to react. And I think it's really difficult to ask that rescue dog to become a service dog for a veteran with PTSD, because they're both going to have non-specific triggers that probably might be unforeseen throughout training and that all of a sudden pop mm-hmm. up and could cause an issue and kind of ruin the reputation of the different organizations that, you know, take the dogs from birth or 8 weeks and raise them up until the time in which they're placed with veterans.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yeah. It's like my dad said, and it's rare that we're able to use rescue dogs, hypothetically. I mean, it would be amazing if that's what we could use, always taking rescue dogs, turning them into service dogs. In a perfect world, that sounds amazing. I have a rescue dog myself. You know, I have a deep heart for rescues, and I'd love to be able to work more with them. But in the past, we've just come through so many issues, and it just tends to not work out.
Let me get to it. Looks like Florence from Bryn Mawr to join our conversation. Florence, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there, Florence. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question. First of all, I'm so impressed with the amount of knowledge these dogs can retain. We have a 14-year-old lab. The only thing she ever learned was to sit and and sit.
Right, exactly.
My question is, how long can they retain this information? I think you talked about recertification, but when you go to recertify, how often do you have to do it? Mm-hmm. And do you find that they've lost some of the knowledge?
It's a great question, Florence, and I'm kind of scanning. Let me start with you, Kevin, because you work directly with NEMA.
Well, what we find is that they're introduced the 92 commands. So how it's explained to me is that they'll retain the commands you use on a regular basis. So it's kind of like programming a TV remote. So they're only going to have the commands that you use on a regular basis. Now, training and whatnot and kind of refreshing and things like that, you can definitely retain a lot more of the commands, obviously. But like the command that NEMA has taught initially, the nightmare one, we're not necessarily a command, but it's a condition which if a veteran's having a violent nightmare and they're tossing and turning, the dog knows to pull the covers off and to turn on the lights. And that's not necessarily something that I have a problem with, so that's maybe something that she will not be as in tune with had she been placed with a veteran that happens on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. So the commands I use, like watch my back, block, things like that, she's more likely to even do that on her own. I'll stop. She'll turn around and face the back because she already knows that that's coming in that situation. So the information that they retain is just, based mm-hmm. upon what they're used on a regular basis.
That's right.
She can salute too, right?
Yes, she can salute. Yes,
I saw
yes.
that.
Oh, she definitely knows that coming because she knows there's food at the end of that rainbow. So, yes.
Ashley, you want to add to that?
It just comes down to practice. Once we can teach these dogs all kinds of different commands, but they're only going to retain as much as they're practiced with. So if you're constantly going over these and doing the consistency and doing the regular practice with them, they're going to retain it. But if you're only going to tell your dog sit over a period of 5 months, then they're going to probably lose a lot of those commands that they were initially taught.
You want to add to that, Dave?
Our dogs in our Paws for Prisons program are all taught wheelchair commands.
Oh, interesting.
A lot of the people that the dogs go to, they're not in a wheelchair, but they know pull left, pull right, pull hard, pull easy, stop, behind, forward. They know all these commands, but of course, they'll lose that over time because you know, that it's just not being used. The foundation is there. Could they be retaught? Would they remember it? Probably, but it would have to be retaught.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Florence talked about continuing ed. I guess it's just sort of reinforcing what they need to do or what the commands mean.
Exactly. We're provided a flip book so that, you know, when I had a larger layover between trains when I was riding up in Northeast Philadelphia, we would go through the different commands like push, you know, pull, things like that, or retrieve, and her able ability to, you know, distinguish between one item and the next item. So we had that ability. I don't have the ability to do it as much now. I don't have that layover, but we still make a point to practice a lot of the commands and things like that. Maybe something that pops in my head, oh, we haven't done this one in a while. Right. Let's see how she is with it. And if she nails it spot on, then so be it. She still has that command. But like I said, I definitely reiterate what they've been saying. It's practice. It's practice. It's reinforcement. It's consistency.
Florence, thanks for the call. Let's see what Michaela from the Art Museum area has to say. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'm both a pet and service dog trainer, and one of the things I often notice about training dogs is that it's extremely challenging and rewarding, the degree of emotional self-regulation one has to have while training a dog. And I'm wondering if the guest can speak to that, and I wonder if that has a therapeutic value for service dog recipients, and I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the challenge of learning to be a really good handler and trainer once you receive a dog.
Once you receive the dog. Can I toss that to you, Ashley?
Sure. I think that it absolutely is therapeutic. There's no question about it. I think that working with a dog in general is therapeutic. I mean, it just at the end of the day, any pet owner knows that, or any dog owner knows that, they go home after a rough day and they kneel down and pet their dog, that, you know, a lot of their anxiety is just going to be immediately, you know, released. So I think there's certainly great benefits from working with dogs and working with the clients, you know, seeing that change in them. It's all very therapeutic, you know, to see that what you're doing is making a difference.
I was wondering too, Dave, about, I guess, the transition from training in the center and then training out in the quote unquote real world. I mean, helping the dog and perhaps their owner sort of adapt to real world conditions.
Anytime you add stimuli, you know, above and beyond in a sterile environment, you know, working in a person's basement or just their kitchen is always a challenge, but it's fun. All of our training, like Ashley said earlier, is fun. We make it fun for the handler, for the dog, it's for us. And to answer your caller's question,
sure.
I lost my train of thought.
Oh, that's okay. I
was thinking about, I'm sure everyone's heard about this very troubling statistic where we lose 22 veterans a day to suicide.
Yes.
One of the things that I said earlier was it's so rewarding to do what we do. And I guess you could say therapeutic, rewarding, however you want to word it. But if you can, in the course of a day's work or a week's worth or a month's work, know that you've helped someone with their disability, but you've even helped in saving someone's life because you could see what the dog has done for this person. Maybe they've tried to commit suicide on two or three occasions, but now they're going out in the public by themselves and they're able to tackle daily chores without the anxieties mm-hmm. that they had before because they used their dog to help mitigate any of those symptoms. That's very rewarding and therapeutic.
Indeed. And just picking up on that, and even Kevin, going back to you, do you think more veterans should think about a service dog in their life?
I think more veterans should be honest about what they're facing. And perhaps that speaks to their journey and where they're at in their lives and their transition to civilian life. Maybe a service dog isn't for everybody and they just don't have time or the energy to fit them in there, but just seeking in some type of care, whether it be support of mental health, you know, professionals or faith or whatever. You got to find what kind of brings you back, because when you go in the military, they train you. You're taught to be a specific way and how to react to things. When you come back, that's not necessarily you need to interact with your world around you anymore. So you need to find what makes you able to kind of like reacclimate yourself to the real world and how, you know, what's a normal reaction again.
Right. Right.
You know, so like I said, service dogs are great. Like I said, she's tremendous for me. Maybe she's not tremendous for other people, but mm-hmm. they need to find that thing that allows them to kind of just, you know, reacclimate. And I hate to use the word normal, and it's not coming back to normal. It's just reacclimating and dealing with what is inside of you now.
Let me see what Hugh from Westchester has to say. Hugh, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi,
yeah,
Hugh. Go ahead.
I certainly applaud the work you're doing with the military people. Are the dogs available? I'm paralyzed from the armpits down. Are they available to non-veterans as well? What would be the cost?
Oh, sure. Well, Hugh, let me toss that back to both Ashley and also to Dave. We've been focusing largely on veterans, but, you know, service dogs can help people in many other situations.
Absolutely.
As well.
I mean, we work with people with a wide range of different disabilities, and we work with people that have their own pet dogs that have that temperament and trainability that we can work with them and their pet dogs to reach the service dog level, and we also help people find dogs that are able to. So yes, we work with people with all different types of disabilities, and the cost ranges drastically. So if it's a dog that is already obedient and, you know, the person is, you know, really committed to the training, it can move, you know, it's less training on us. So therefore it's less money. The cost can range anywhere from a couple thousand dollars to $15,000. So it's over, you know, the course of at least 6 months, sometimes up to 2 years. And that's really all dependent upon the person and the dog. So it really right. comes back to them, and it's all over the board. there's no set cost. And that's just, you know,
the two major factors
Hugh,
would be
thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
The two major factors would be the trainability of the dog and the level of involvement of the person who's going to be working. Because ultimately, we train each dog handler team, especially the handler, to be the trainer. They're the ones that work with the dog every day. They're the ones that practice.
Yeah.
And we've had some dogs and some customers, within just a few short weeks, they're able to pass through phases that other dogs, you know, and handlers take months. Mm.
We're almost out of time, and we can't take George's question on the phone, but I have it here on my screen. How do service dogs retire? I mean, what is the process of that? And I guess I'm back to the two of you.
How
do you know they're ready to retire, perhaps?
They pretty much tell you. you know when they're slowing down. Normally they remain as a household pet after that time, but it's once it's putting too much pressure on the dog and it varies again with age. You know, some dogs are able to do it longer than others. But it depends on the disability that they're mitigating as well. So balanced support dogs that are, you know, taking a lot of pressure there, they may not be able to do it as long as other dogs. So it varies.
Yeah. You want to add to that, Dave? Anything else?
I think that was well said. And again, it's, you know, when they become less effective, we've had typically what we like to do is transition in their new service dog, you know, when the old one is starting to retire. That could take over 2 years.
Right. Well, it's been a great pleasure. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. Kevin Brackney, as he was telling us, served two tours in Iraq. He's currently a Presidential Management Fellow at the Delaware Commission of Veterans Affairs with the Philadelphia VA Medical Center. He brought his service dog named Nima. Also with us, Dave Burry. He's a service dog trainer at PAWS Training Centers in Westchester, PA, as is his daughter, Ashley O'Hara, and they brought Brooke with them. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show. We took some photos of our guests today and their dogs, and I'm sure they'll be posted on our Facebook page and on our homepage as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowain, and again, the name of the book, Unconditional Honor, Wounded Warriors and Their Dogs. Thanks for joining us.